Since the dawn of recording history, mankind has been obsessed with his bollocks. Bollocks. Bollocks.
Welcome to Jim's Bag of Bollocks, your friendly internet companion in an age of mistrust.
I am a robot. Tech news.
In a spectacular case of nutcracker sledgehammer confusion, the government has recently proposed legislation intended to force ISPs to crack down on illegal file sharers. If passed, this lunatic, unworkable set of laws would effectively turn your broadband provider into an internet police force, enforcing a three-strikes policy that they apparently already operate in France. Of all places. If they find out you've been sharing copyrighted material and how exactly they managed to do that with any degree of reliability is a mystery, you'll be given a warning via email. Further transgression will result in a temporary internet ban, which presumably you won't be reimbursed for, and the fatal third strike will force your ISP to terminate your contract. You think that's bad? You think that's a gross violation of privacy? Well, it gets worse. There's also talk of the offending file sharer's details being made available to all the other ISPs, effectively banning this theoretical triple offender from the internet for life. Any ISP that doesn't uphold this law is in danger of being fined a ridiculous amount of money for every file sharer it fails to bust. This, along with the added overhead of network surveillance, is probably going to drive up the cost of broadband subscription, something which is ridiculously high in this country as it is. I can't believe that a government with such an embarrassing track record of treating our personal information with such outright nonchalance, bordering on contempt, is now proposing the enforcement of an almost Orwellian breach of civil liberties. I don't want my ISP logging and observing everything I do with the bandwidth I buy from them, any more than I want Royal Mail to scrutinise and take copies of every letter I post. Going back to a previous point, the other huge issue is that of detection. Even with technologies like deep packet inspection, it's basically impossible to tell the difference between the illegal sharing of copyrighted material and other perfectly legitimate exchanges of similar media. This podcast is my intellectual property, but as far as my ISP can tell, it's just a big MP3 file. How do they know it isn't the latest Shakira album? The point is, they don't. So without sufficient ground to warn me, but with the threat of a massive fine breathing down their necks, which side of the legal conundrum do you think they're going to err on? Probably not mine. Even the most innocuous, perfectly legit file transfer could put an internet user at risk of losing a strike. Our freedoms have been eroded enough over the past 7 years. Can we please stop this madness?
Tellywank.
On the headlines tonight, David Bowie has been arrested in connection with the fatal wounding of two police officers.
It is said that in the moment between life and death, your life flashes before you.
It's July 1981.
When I saw the bullet, I thought, this is it, Alex.
This is how it ends.
Only it hasn't ended. And I am most definitely here.
A couple of weeks ago, BBC One finally gave the answer to a nail-biting, year-long question. Will Ashes to Ashes be anywhere near as good as its parent series, Life on Mars? For those of you who wouldn't know good telly if you caught it urinating on your sofa, Life on Mars was a fantasy police drama about Sam Tyler, a DCI from 2006 who finds himself trapped in 1973. And to paraphrase the opening monologue, he didn't know if he was mad, in a coma, or back in time. I could go on, but I'm reasonably sure most people listening to this have at least a passing familiarity with the series, and I'm willing to bet most of you were fans. On to business then, and the answer to the question posed earlier is sadly a resounding no. Ashes to Ashes has a very similar setup to its parent. Well, it's pretty much a carbon copy, a fact which is knowingly embraced by the writers. D.I. Alex Drake, played by Keeley Hawes or that lass from Spooks, suffers a near-fatal wounding in 2008, only to find herself whisked back in time to 1981. The twist here is that Alex is a police psychologist who's studied reports filed by Sam Tyler about his coma-induced experience. This causes her to recreate the very same world. She knows what to expect, and she recognises the primary characters, including, of course, the marvellous Gene Hunt.
Amy, my reputation precedes me.
Ah yes, Gene Hunt, the wisecracking, no-nonsense, politically erroneous copper we all know and absolutely adore. Truly, I'm not being sarcastic, he's amazing. Testosterone incarnate. A Wild West sheriff with a northern twang and steel-capped boots. A perfect blend of John McClane, Captain Kirk, and Jeremy Clarkson. Oh God, how I love him. I suspect you do too. Still, I felt we could have done without the sheer wankfest of a fanfare that ensued almost every time he entered the frame. Actually, Ashes to Ashes spent quite a bit of time wanking over itself, and it does, at times, feel like a fan-written tribute to Life on Mars instead of being its own show. Once the first episode gets underway and Keeley Hawes finds herself back in 1981, the plot centres around the massive cocaine and heroin trade in central London. Drake wakes up in the middle of a decadent party on the Thames, on a boat filled with bankers, big-time drug dealers and hookers, to the tune of Vienna by Ultravox. The show loses some points here for reminding me of Midge, and by association Bob Geldof, and by association every other proselytising millionaire rockstar fuck who thinks the world's injustices can be solved by televising a Coldplay gig. And it made me go on this pointless digression so you can shove your Ah Vienna right down Bono's cock. Having said that, the soundtrack is nothing short of absolutely superb. David Bowie, of course, makes an appearance alongside greats like The Stranglers, Gary Numan and The Clash. Gene's heroic entrance rocks out to Duran Duran's underrated single Careless Memories, probably the coolest song they ever did. The first meeting between our new protagonist and the boss of the old one kicks off with a typical one-liner aimed at the coke-snorting Thatcherite cockstain holding Drake hostage.
Today, my friend, your diary entry will read, took a prosy hostage and was shot by three armed bastards.
Said Thatcherite cockstain is eventually talked into coming quietly by Drake's use of irritating psychobabble, while Gene and the gang watch the exchange with furrowed brows, like Neanderthals watching someone play SimCity. That's pretty much how the relationship continues for the rest of the episode. I felt Drake was too much of a smart-ass know-it-all for our own good. You know those episodes of Doctor Who where David Tennant emerges from the TARDIS and says something like, "Oh, this is the Martian toilet, I've seen loads of these, look at these glory holes, it takes me back." Well, she's a bit like that, but more irritating. As Drake starts to work with Jean in order to bring down the inner-city drug trade, having decided that this is what she needs to do before she can wake up, we're treated to a slew of cerebral moments which deliberately make very little sense, presumably in a bid to out-weird Life on Mars. The clown from David Bowie's Ashes to Ashes video fills the role of the test card girl, and to be fair, it is bloody creepy. Creepier still is the appearance of Zippy and George from Rainbow, and I hope they become a regular fixture of the series because I actually enjoy not knowing whether to laugh loudly or curl up into a ball and cry myself to sleep.
Forget your mum, Molly. She's never coming back.
Anyway, the episode leads up to a riverbank shootout between the police and the big scary drug people. Gene divides his officers into three teams, calling his the A-Team in an obvious reference to the show of the same name. What seems like a throwaway pop culture gag actually gets drawn out over the next 10 minutes, in which bullets don't seem to hurt people, just like in the A-Team. Now this was jarring to me because Life on Mars, while it did have a few out-there moments, was always grounded by serious narratives and stark realism. Ashes to Ashes didn't seem very concerned with realism. In fact, it didn't seem too concerned with the plot either. It all seemed a bit over the top until I realised what the writers were doing, and I'm certain they did it consciously. I think it was trying to be a thematic metaphor for the era in which it's set. I'm not being silly, hear me out. The 80s was, of course, the decade of excess. Ashes to Ashes is essentially Life on Mars taken to excesses. The 80s will forever be remembered for Thatcherite yuppies, relentless materialism, and utter shallowness. If Life on Mars is an Olympic pool, Ashes to Ashes is a thimble of Ribena. Once I'd fully absorbed that, I found myself enjoying it a hell of a lot more. Figuratively speaking, I wanked along with it, all the while in a state of drooling fanboy glee. Unfortunately, said fanboy glee didn't really have enough momentum to carry over to the second episode, which, while okay in its sort of okayness, has started to make me worry about the direction this series is taking. It's already suffering from the recurring annoyance of D.I. Drake's insistence on being a smarmy know-it-all bitch. She swans about the place, casually denouncing her fellow characters as constructs and bleating on to anyone who'll listen about how the entire scenario is just a big fluffy, consequence-free, subconscious fabrication. Frankly, it's beginning to grate, not just because of my normal human dislike of big-headed smugness, but also because it makes it difficult for me to get emotionally invested in the show. Being the ridiculously neurotic anal fuckwit that I am, I simply can't get past the cold hard reality that the events on screen aren't even really happening in the universe they're set in, and it doesn't help that the main protagonist seems hell-bent on reminding me of that fact.
An exploding dog from my psyche.
Thank you, Frontal Cortex. Look and learn constructs. It's not real. The left did come to see Thatcherism as a necessary political evil. Unions were emasculated, which led to the abolition of Clause 4 and the rise of New Labour.
If you've quite finished D.I. Drake.
As an aside, if I found myself in D.I. Drake's situation, I'd think sod going to work in my own cerebral fantasy. I'd just wander around doing whatever time-wasting nonsense I could think of. I'd see how much unprotected sex I could have with the skankiest whores I could find. I'd steal rotisserie chicken from Tesco's and eat it in front of starving tramps. I'd operate the business end of a glory hole with a belt sander and a length of cheese wire. I'd even watch a selection of films starring Tom Cruise, if only to get myself angry enough to gun down pedestrians from the roof of a box factory. Yes, it would be my own personal Grand Theft Auto. Why would you even want to return to the thrombosis-inducing monotony of everyday life? I've gone on a bit of a tangent here, haven't I? Anyway, if it doesn't pull its socks up by episode 3, I'm officially jumping ship.
Right. Let's fire up the quattro.
Visually, it's absolutely splendid. They've done a bang-up job of recreating the period. The sets and locations are airbrushed, dirtied up, and sprinkled liberally with props from the time, and anyone who remembers the 80s will find a lot of nostalgic value here. You'll wake up the next morning harbouring a desire to watch Roland rap with your Frosties. To wrap up, and this is such a boring and predictable thing to say, but it's the truth, if you liked Life on Mars, you should find something to like about this, and despite its long, long list of faults, it's worth watching for Gene Hunt alone. That's a very shallow attitude, of course, but I am, after all, a child of the 80s. That was a clever finish, wasn't it? Did you see that? I totally owned that review.
Game Souls.
I want to talk about Zack and Wiki, the point-and-click puzzle-em-up on the Nintendo Wii. Critics have been harping on about this title over the pond with such enthusiasm that you'd be forgiven for thinking Capcom's marketing budget has a few billion yen set aside for hiring well-trained high-class prostitutes to pleasure game reviewers while they play it. Unfortunately, I'm not a professional, so I won't be getting a share of the whore fund, meaning I'm under no obligation to tout the fucking thing as an actual viable alternative to hardcore pornography. It's somehow poetic then that my biggest gripe with the game is that it's too bloody hard. I realise that it's quite a wimpy mummy's boy criticism, but I swear it's the honest truth. It's so true in fact that I haven't even been able to get through enough of the game to give it a valid review, but I'll soldier on anyway because I can't be bothered playing anything else. Zack and Wiki is a bit like a cross between Monkey Island and Fahrenheit, with a very simple, barely existent plot and a bit of WarioWare thrown in. On the surface, it looks like a classic point-and-click adventure game, but there's honestly no real adventuring to be done. The game is separated into themed stages, each one divided into a selection of levels. Each level is essentially a large puzzle that can be solved by dicking about with the various items and objects in the playing field. You jump through a set of predefined hoops, avoiding enemies and pitfalls along the way, and by the end you gain a piece of treasure and a load of points. Unfortunately, the game is a bit too trial and error for its own good. There are far too many levels in which you can be forced to suffer a long, drawn-out death scene for simply following a logical series of actions. It would have been impossible to have figured out something was going to cock up without the gift of omniscience. I don't mind being made a fool of by a game that thwarts my admittedly abysmal lateral thinking skills, that's fair enough. But coaxing me into a seemingly reasonable course of action and throwing a lethal curveball like, "By the way, this floor stone's a pressure pad actually, you fail!" simply isn't cricket. It's not even netball. It's deal or no deal. A lot of the solutions require you to manipulate the environment with tools, for example, a saw, which, by the way, you get by making your flying brass monkey ring its bell near a centipede. For fans of cutesy Japanese weirdness, this is possibly the game to end all games. You'd control the saw by holding the Wiimote as you would a saw handle in real life, and then by moving it back and forth. It's simple and kind of fun, but I've noticed a few annoying glitches with the motion sensing that can hamper your progress somewhat. Another motion sensing portion of the game has you controlling a fishing rod, a bit like the fishing minigame in Twilight Princess. This sequence requires you to violently bob the Wiimote when told to, and then hold it still when signaled to stop. If you don't play this bastardization of musical statues to a level of inhuman perfection, it results in yet another
fail.
Now that would be frustrating enough if the game flawlessly registered your movements, but it doesn't. As a result, the fishing sequence is an almost impossible chore that makes doing a mountain of dishes seem like a joyous festival of jam-filled gaiety by comparison. By no means a bad game, in fact it's one of the best third-party titles on the Wii, but if Capcom was a comprehensive school in the southeast of England, its developers would receive a report card this year saying, reasonably attentive, must do better. If I'm being honest, it disappointed me because I've always associated point-and-click games with intricate involving storylines, deep characterization, and generally more depth than you can shake a rainforest at. Zack and Wiki has none of those things and less, because it's not that kind of game. It's a puzzler, pure and simple. I know people who loved Monkey Island as a lateral thinking exercise, but could never be bothered with the storyline and they always skip through the dialogue. Well, Zack and Wiki is almost tailor-made for them. The cunts.
Endgame.
So the trailer for the fourth Indiana Jones film finally made it to the internets this week, leaving me thoroughly unimpressed and almost certain that Indy 4 will be something of a disappointment. It starts off with a montage of iconic shots from the original trilogy, which of course leads into the proper teaser for the new film. This approach struck me as a bit like standing a reasonably attractive Lara Croft impersonator next to Angelina Jolie. Also, there's a worrying shot of rising star Shia LaBeouf sporting indie regalia that almost reeks of an attempt to pass the torch, as it were, which filled me with an overwhelming sense of dread about the whole thing. It's like the run-up to Phantom Menace all over again. Anyway, I'm off. I'll be back in a few weeks for another belated but more relaxed edition of Jim's Bag of Bollocks, the 1400th greatest podcast in the world. Bye, Betcheg!
Bollocks. Bollocks.
For further information and links associated with the topics covered in this episode, why not visit the blog page at www.bagofbollocks.co.uk. If you like the show, tell your friends, get them to subscribe. The more, the merrier. Please drop me an email on feedback@bagofbollocks.co.uk. Thank you for listening.